Hey, Snappers. It's your boy, Glenn, and I am so excited because on Friday, May 8th, we're going to do our biggest, baddest live show ever in New York City. It's Brooklyn Bam, and guess what? We've got Tariq, Black Thought Trotter from The Roots and The Tonight Show is going to be in the Snap program. Mike Daisy is going to hit the Snap stage for the first time, and you've asked for it, and we've got it. The return of James Judd and the hilarious Jen Colbert. The show is going to be off the hook. Get tickets while you can at snapjudgment.org. Peace. Okay, so one of the places I love, almost more than anywhere else, is backstage. Backstage, maybe an hour before opening night, the big show. No one knows if it's gonna work. Are they gonna love us?
Places! They're running other places!
And these big, beefy fellas with belts and tools and equipment running around measuring stuff. The lights, blues, reds, yellows, that flash on stage. And each storyteller has their own ritual. Someone to close their eyes, hide in the darkest corners of the dark curtains. And others, they want their eyes wide open. The band starts up, hits us with a few notes to let everybody know the beat is ready. You better get ready too. Stay on Snap Judgment. From PRX and NPR, we proudly present Encore.
Encore.
Because you never know what's going to happen when you bare your soul. My name is Glenn Washington. I get to be the host. You get the very best seat in the house. We're showcasing some of our favorite stories from Snap Live episodes. We're kicking off today's episode with a story originally performed for Snap Judgment Live in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Our next guest is the hardest working woman in comedy. Yes, indeed. Please put your hands together for Ms. Caitlin Gale.
I was young. It's not that I was big boned. It's just that I had delicious emotions. I think it all started at church. It was never my scene and I was always nervous. But every week they had this big, huge box of donuts. At some point, I realized that if you are always holding half of a donut, it always looks like you're on your first donut. Even if you're on your seventh donut. It must have been a trick I learned from watching my grandpa drink scotch. It was all just baby fat. Until I wasn't a baby anymore. All of a sudden I was in high school, where there are dates and dresses and dances and all sorts of other tortures designed for the obese and the insecure. By the time I stopped trying, I had asked 13 boys to dances and heard 13 no's. That's a baker's dozen. I was sad because I was fat, and I was fat because I was sad. Now, through all this, I did manage to make some great friends. And those friends and I decided that the end of our sophomore year of high school was going to be something worth celebrating. We were going to get tickets to the biggest concert event of the summer, Live 105's BFD. BFD! The concert's so epic, they almost swear about it on the radio. We all know what that F stands for. We went to the concert, and it was amazing. We saw Erasure, and we saw the Squirrel Nut Zippers, and we saw Blur, and we saw The Cure. It was a very big deal for the 90s. After the concert, we all left the arena, went into the parking lot, and stuffed ourselves into my best friend's minivan. So full now, somebody had to sit on the floor. As we were leaving, the traffic was crazy, and everybody was hungry, so we decided to stop at a Taco Bell. Now, this decision was also made by half of the gazillion people we were just at a concert with. so the drive-through line was a little bit long. We all got out of the van and were just milling around in the parking lot. And when it was time to get back in, it was declared that the first to arrive back at the van would get to sit shotgun, and the last would have to sit on the floor. This resulted in a sprint, which, predictably, I lost. Of course I lost a sprint. I was stuck in a beef loaf of a body. It didn't sprint anywhere. And of course, I couldn't spend a full day without feeling like a fatty McFat-Fat. I always felt like my body kept me away from other people. This time, I literally didn't have a seat. I sat there with my sad butt on the floor of the van, sliding door open, my sad feet on the sad pavement. And that's when the van started moving. Now, what happened next only took about a second, but I had a lot of time to think about it. The van's moving. I should probably lift up my legs. Gee, you know, now that the van's moving, it seems a lot harder to lift up my legs. Hey, I never noticed how close that tire was to my leg. Oh my God, my legs! The van sucked my right leg right under the tire. I flopped out of the van, and I landed on my back. I looked down to assess the situation, and I could see that my right knee had been bent so that my foot was touching my hip. But my toes were pointing right at the sky. I realized this wasn't my only immediate concern when my gaze continued downward to discover that the minivan had come to rest on my left leg. My best friend got out of the car, winding all the way around to see what happened and stopped short when he saw me. I looked up at him and I said, "My leg is broken. Please move your car." He ran all the way back around, he climbed back in the van, he restarted it, and he pulled it off my leg. The pain I was in was otherworldly. I had not experienced anything like it before, and I have not since. I was in shock, and the shock was making me twitch, and every twitch would just send cramps down the damaged meat in my leg. And the way it was bent, there was no fixing anything until we got to a hospital, which meant that a fireman had to stand above me and use his bare hands to bend a metal leg brace to accommodate the new curve in my leg. You know, even when you're laying on the ground grievously injured, there really is something about a man in uniform. The rest of the night gets a little fuzzy. I remember learning that morphine is a hell of a drug. It turns out that my leg wasn't broken, but my kneecap had gone from the front of my leg to the back of my leg. A doctor and a few orderlies took a running start and yanked my leg back into place. They braced me up and they sent me home. The next morning, when I woke up, I would have given anything to have my body back the way it was the day before, when I hated it. And I have never hated my body again. I also quickly learned that crutching is a great core workout, Vicodin is an appetite suppressant, and physical therapists are very serious about their work. I lost all the weight I didn't need to carry anymore. I should make it clear that I do not endorse getting hit by a minivan as a weight loss plan. I lost 30 pounds in 10 days. That's not Weight Watchers. That's when doctors start watching your kidneys. But as terrible and painful as getting run over by a minivan was, I would not change a single thing about what happened that day. That was the event in my life that revealed my beauty to myself. It's the beauty we all share. It's the beauty of these bodies. As a bonus, it turns out that getting run over by a minivan in a Taco Bell parking lot after a concert makes a pretty good story. It's a story that when I came back to school the next year, people asked me to tell over and over and over again. And I figured out that they liked it better when it was funny. And I really, really loved making them laugh. That was half my life ago. Today, I'm a stand-up comedian. I'd like to close tonight by responding to what I think must be the best senior quote penned in any yearbook, anywhere, ever. Dear Caitlin, sorry we ran you over. Apologies accepted. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Caitlin Gill. Look this woman up wherever internets are found. We'll have the film version of the story on our website, snapjudgment.org. Now, our next storyteller makes fun of California. Well, that's all right, because California can take it. His hilarious brother, book him for your next world tour, Mr. Joe Klosik.
I am a stand-up comic, and I get an email for a gig in the Northern California town of Redding. If you don't know Redding, California, I think the best way to describe it is, it's where 1972 went. The email starts out with this disclaimer. Quote, please be advised this venue prominently displays a Confederate flag. It's not indicative of their philosophy there. I've booked many diverse shows at this venue. Have fun. How could I not take that gig? I get up there and I'm standing outside the place. There's a doorman. I've never met him. He's never met me. First words out of his mouth to me are, you know, I can always tell when black people are around. Whoa! Yeah, so can I. They're black. Are you a psychic racist? And I walk into the place and I look up and yes, there's a Confederate flag, but above it is the biggest American flag I've ever seen in my life. I want you to think like Chevy truck commercial, halftime at the Super Bowl, America big. And then under it is the Confederate flag, and hanging on either side of it are those naked women mud flap silhouettes. Classy, right? Hanging at the bottom of the Confederate disco ball. This is the most confused dream catcher ever. Does it come together in some way? Is there a meaning, you know? America, if you're different, we don't want you. Women are objects, gays are okay. I don't think that's what it meant. Right before I come on stage, the owner comes up to me and says, don't make fun of the Confederate flag. Let me tell you guys something, maybe you know. If you want a comedian to not make fun of something, don't tell him to not make fun of it. 10 minutes into the show, I look out at the crowd, I look up at the flag, and then I go, what's up, Dukes of Hazzard fans? That's when everything changed. This low, mean sound came out of the crowd. They hated what I had just said, and I was too busy worrying about that because out of the darkness, objects started coming at me. At first it was just a fry basket and then some fries and then there was like a fork and then there was a rock. A rock? Someone brought a rock in here? Why is there a rock? More stuff is coming at me. They're yelling stuff at me. You suck! Get off the stage! Your family tree probably looks like a pretzel. More stuff is coming at me. I'm dodging a boot, a belt buckle, a belt buckle. And they are getting me. They are getting me, and I am backing up. And then I remember, I'm a comic. I am a comic. These are my words. This is truth. I am not going to back down. There's no way I'm going to back down. And then they all come together to chant. We're number one. We're number one. We're number one. We're number one. Really? Because that flag means you're number two. After all the tables got put back right and the cops left and I got paid somehow, I walked out of the building and I'm headed towards my car. And like somebody had just been in an accident, all of the adrenaline drains out of me. And I suddenly realize I almost got killed back there. Those guys wanted to kill me for jokes and words. And I can feel my body shake and I silently resolve to never put myself in that position again. I'm almost at my car when this guy gets directly in front of me. I call him a tether drunk. You know what a tether drunk is? They look like this. It looks like they're gonna fall, but they never quite do. Yeah. I'm getting dizzy just trying to keep eye contact. And he gets in my face and he goes, "I don't like what you said about the flag, boy." And I can feel that comic rage rise again. And I'm just like, why are you so proud of it? I don't take people back to my house and show them my collage of losing lottery tickets. Take it down. Yes, but you weren't there that night, were you? And I can see in his eyes, he's gonna throw a punch. And he starts to, but he's so slow and so drunk that all I have to do to avoid the punch is literally just go. His fist goes past my head. He pulls it back and I straighten up. And what makes this amazing is what this guy said next. He just looks at me and goes, "All right, you're pretty fast, Matrix."
Joe Klosik, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Snap Judgment Live, the encore episode, featuring some stories we just couldn't let get away. And know this, even now, we're rehearsing for our biggest show ever in New York City, May 8th at BAM in Brooklyn, as part of WNYC's Radio Love Fest. This show is going to be incredible, and we'd love to see as many real snappers there as possible. We're featuring Tariq Trotter, Black Thought from The Roots, and The Tonight Show. You know him, Mike Daisy, the hilarious Jen Colbert, the return of James Judd, and more. Get your tickets right now at snapjudgment.org. Now, when Snap returns, we've got a grandmother story like you won't believe. When Snap Live Encore Edition continues, stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Check out the Fresh Air podcast. Fresh Air interviews are a great way to get to know people like Jon Stewart, Amy Poehler, Louis C.K., the creators of Mad Men, Better Call Saul, Justified, and House of Cards. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment Live, the Encore Special. Next in our lineup, a modern-day Renaissance man, poet, rapper, actor, activist, one of the very first people I tried to get on the show. Please note, this story does use a word that is never cool for polite company. or really most company at all. Snap judgment.
Please put your hands together for Mr. Ice Life.
I remember when I didn't know I was black. I didn't know better. I mean, I had no sense of one group of people being better than or greater than another. At best, I knew that certain people belonged in certain places. For example, the orange people that spoke something my mama called Spanish, they lived in the Fruitvale. And they sold fruit in bags. The people who were the same color as my grandma, they were on TV, you know, like the news. And also, there were cartoons. Elmer Fudd, Yosemite Sam, Daffy Duck was a duck. But somehow I knew he was the same color as my grandma too. The kids I went to school with sleepy eyes, they were from far away. And they always had rice in their lunch bags. Peanut butter jelly sandwiches and Capri Suns went in mine. My grandma was born Billy Matzka in 1933 to a family of poor Irish farm workers. Yes, me. Revolutionary black power rapper man, me. My first best friend was an old white lady, my grandma, and I loved her very much. I guess because she grew up poor on a farm, she knew how to make fun out of absolutely nothing. Well, I'd say nothing. Grandma say nothing. For example, she'd take the peaches that came in cans and she'd dump them in the sink, you know, and then she'd put the cans on the ground. And she'd tap holes in the cans. And then she'd run string through the cans up to the height of my hands. And in her groggy voice, she'd go, "Stand on the cans, Isaac." And I'd get on the cans, and she'd put the string in my hands like reins. They were stilts. Ha! I'd walk around the yard 6 inches taller than I really was. Clank, 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 clank. I felt like a giant. The kids I went to school with, they made a big deal out of me having a white grandma. Most of us never got to see white people up close unless it was the police. So me having a white grandma meant I got to see Bigfoot up close. She'd pull up to the school to pick me up. They'd go, "That's your grandma?" And I'd go, "Yep." And I'd run off to the car. Grandma had this long, old gold Ford. It didn't have a tape deck. It didn't even have an FM radio. But Grandma didn't care. AM radio provided the soundtrack for old white lady daily life. The songs always had this real kind of, you know... slow, boring, and redundant. Easy to dance to. Reminiscent of Jim Crow, but sounds like music to you. But I didn't know they were old white lady songs. I just knew they were songs that my grandma liked. I'd be right next to her singing along. As I got older, I stopped getting picked up by grandma and I started catching the bus to her house by myself. I graduated from my peach can stilts to bouts of Scrabble with my grandmother. Me and my grandma, we played Scrabble. It's when I first fell in love with the concept of tying words together, you know? Not only did I graduate from my peach can stilts, I also graduated from my naive view on race. By the time I was 12 years old, I was quite clear that in this country, white meant better. Not only did I graduate from my naive view on race, so did my homies at school. They went from thinking it was cool that I had a white grandma to teasing me for it. That didn't bother me. What did bother me, though, was commentary from two homies in my hood, Kevin and Brandon. Brandon joined the Nation of Islam, and he was 19 when I was 12, so we all thought he was like a super grown-up, you know? He'd stand booming from the corner like it was a podium. All white people are devils. They're all racist. They enslaved black people. They enslaved the whole world. It would drive me crazy. I'd argue with him, going on and on about how that wasn't true. My grandmother was proof. She was a white woman married to a black man and had black children. How could she be racist? Here came Cool Kev. Blood. Just because she be around black people don't mean she ain't racist. Black people don't like black people. So you know white folks don't. I felt defeated on the issue, but not about my grandma. I knew she wasn't racist, and she loved me very much. The summer that I was 14 years old, I went and spent the summer with my brother in Fresno, and my sisters, they flew down to San Diego to spend time with our uncle. When I got back home, I landed at the airport. My mama said, "Ice, where you want to go?" What did I say? Grandma's house. Off we went. We got there, and right away, Grandma started setting up the Scrabble board. She started asking me all the questions that grandmas ask, you know. How was your trip? How's your brother? Did you eat? Like I'm not gonna eat. Did you talk to your sisters while you were gone? No, but Connie wrote me a letter. She said they're getting dark tans down there from all the sun. And then my world changed forever. My grandmother reached across the table and touched my hand. She said, "Oh no, they're gonna come back looking like little niggers." I fell down inside. Then I died a little. I can't tell you what happened next. I don't know if it was nighttime or daytime when we left. I regained consciousness in my bed. Weeping, mourning, the way it feels to mourn something you hold tight against the fabric of your being, the thing I was holding on to with all of my young might, the part of me that didn't want to live in a world where anyone, and surely not my grandmother, saw me as a nigger, useless, a dumb. For the years that grew into my teenage years, I imagine I saw my grandmother no more than a dozen times. We never talked about it. And I just used it as another layer on the callus to weather day-to-day life in the hood. Recently, though, I started writing my grandmother a letter. I wrote about what I felt like she took away from me that day in the kitchen. How it made me feel. From a space of growth, I also wrote about my travels and everywhere I've been because I knew she'd enjoy that. And for a moment, I felt a certain nostalgia and it was good to feel her close to me again. My grandmother died before I could deliver my letter. And with her death, also went the opportunity for us to confront this issue and maybe put it behind us. Love conquers hate. But where was the love? Thank you.
That was Ice Life from his Oakland, California performance. And please know that amazing video of each performance that you're hearing right now is available at snapjudgment.org. Share this story with someone you love. And next up, from the same night, a dear friend of mine, she's blowing up on various venues around the country. But listen to her first on Snap Judgment. I know you're going to dig it. Enjoy.
Our next guest is a comedian, a nerd, and she actually taught
charm school at MIT. Please put your hands together. It's Miss Daya Lakshmi Narayanan.
I get a phone call while I'm away at college. It's my mother, my perfectly round mother. She describes herself as a jolly optimist. Once she convinced a family friend of ours not to take her own life by saying, "Suicide? No, you will not do this." Because you are too lazy. You will get the stool and the rope and think, "I'll do it just tomorrow." It worked. That lady's still alive now. I pick up the phone. "Baby, it's me. No need to worry. Everything will be okay. You don't have to come home." I freak out and book a ticket home. I fly home to find my dad, checked out. He's reclining on the lazy boy, watching bad TV reruns. "Hey, Dad. How are you doing?" "Shh. Matlock is real." My dad had just been laid off. And to add humiliation to trauma, he became one of the millions of Americans denied health insurance because of a previously existing condition, diabetes. My brother could feel the middle-class American dream slipping through our hands. "Daya, do I have to make fast food burgers? Because that's what the kids at school say that poor people have to do." This was a double insult, because this meant he wouldn't make that much money, and we were Hindu vegetarians. My family's future was riding on my mom overcoming her past. My mom immigrated from Chennai, India when she was 21 years old. She was the oldest of five children. Her dad died when she was 9 years old, and her mother, my grandmother, was a widow in South Indian society, an outcast. She had to give up her children to be raised by others. When my mother married my dad, she weighed 85 pounds because of malnutrition. And she's my height, 5 feet. In the wedding pictures, she looks beautiful and damn hungry. It was this time that my mom decided that she wanted to go back to school. "Baby, I think at this age, 40, I want to go back to school." "Mom, you're 45. We don't have to tell everybody the truth all the time." She asked me to help out. She has to take a basic math exam to get into school. And she's getting stuck on the transitive property. Transitive property. Two definitions. First, of or characterized by transition. My family knew this all too well. My mom only admitted to me a few years ago we were on food stamps for the first 3 years of my life. Definition number two from math: if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, therefore A is equal to C. "I don't understand this. Explain it to me again. Explain it to me again." "Well, it just means if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, therefore A is equal to C." "You just said the same thing slower and louder. That doesn't help me." Well, I don't know what to do. So then I decide to explain it in Tamil, which is my mom's first language. But the thing is, I don't know how to say equals in Tamil. And A, there's five characters associated with A. So it ends up just sounding like A, B, equal on the, B, C, equal on the, A, C, equal. "You just said the same thing with useless Tamil words thrown in for my benefit." I don't know how else to explain this to you. This is basic math. It's very easy. Didn't you learn this at school or anything? And at this moment, my mother speaks to me directly in Tamil. And when she speaks in Tamil, it's like speaking in italics, because she's about to say something honest and truthful that's not masked by humor and jokes. So translated, it was something like, in my childhood, nobody cared if I had eaten that day. If I was at school, it meant I was out of the way. Didn't matter if I learned anything. This is why I'm not smart. Not like you and your brother. Mom, you're smart. You're really smart. You had to learn English when you came to the United States. How did you do that? Lucy, Carol Burnett, TV shows. That's American, Mom. Okay. What's your favorite show now? The one with the Jew. Can you be more specific? Seinfeld. 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 Okay. Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld. So, like, if Jerry Seinfeld tells Elaine a secret, that's like A is equal to B. And if Elaine tells that secret to Kramer, B equals C, that's just as if Jerry had told Kramer in the first place. A is equal to C. Oh, it is very simple. My dad is retired and he has health insurance. His diabetes is under control. He doesn't watch Matlock. He prefers Monk. My brother, he doesn't make as much money as he would have if he stayed flipping burgers. Because he's a graduate student at Yale. My mom passed that exam. She got into school, and now she works as a software engineer. She has finished watching all the Seinfeld episodes, so now she tries to explain Friends to me. A and B went out, B and C broke up, D and E got back together, so that's just like A and E dating, right? That's my mom.
You're listening to Snap Judgment Live, the encore episode. And don't forget, May 8th in New York City, Snap is taping a brand new live show, the likes of which have never been seen. Get your tickets now at snapjudgment.org. And when Snap returns, discover how to channel your inner Madonna and what happens when you and your family do not speak the same language. Snap Judgment Live, the encore episode. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads other people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the Porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts.
PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment Live, the encore episode, already in progress.
That's right. Get ready. So our next guest, Vijay Nathan. She spent her entire career getting on our parents' last nerve. And today, you're going to find out why they're kind of proud of her. Please put your hands together. Vijay
Nathan.
When I was little, I loved riding in the car with my mom because she always let me control the radio. That station wagon was my personal disco. And I became Madonna. Lucky Star, Material Girl, Like a Virgin. That was my favorite. One time I sang the song extra loud to see if my mom knew what the words meant. Like a virgin, touched for the very first time. Like a was as far as I got. One hand on the wheel, the other at my throat. She said, Vijay, you are not like a virgin. You are a virgin. My sisters and I weren't allowed to talk about or think about sex. According to my mom, sex is only for the Americans. I mean, every day she would tell me that I would get an arranged marriage and that I would never date and that I would be pure and perfect on my wedding night. And I believed this until I went to college. There I met girls who were so carefree and liberated, they consumed men like pieces of cheese. So at 20 years old, even though I was the youngest girl in my family, I decided that I was going to be the first to lose my virginity. But I was going to be smart about it. I wanted a man who would be great in bed, but never break my heart. I found the perfect specimen at my summer job waitressing at the Woodmont Country Club. Kevin Williams. 23. 6'2". Sexy, athletic body. IQ of a mango. No chance of falling in love. So after weeks of making out in his car, I was ready to take the next step. Friday night, I went to the Safeway in the Orthodox Jewish neighborhood so I wouldn't run into anyone that I knew. There, I bought condoms, spermicide, KY jelly, and a Snickers. I didn't want to look like a total deviant to the checkout girl. Saturday night, I went to Kevin's house, and we did it. And I could have been anyone to him, and he could have been anyone to me. And I didn't feel so liberated. Nothing had changed. I was still me. Afterwards, we shared the Snickers. But I decided that I'd wait for love or marriage before I ever did it again. Now, quality time in my family is Sunday brunch at my dad's golf club. He doesn't know how to play, but he insists it's good for business contacts. After the meal, he says, let's take a walk, just me, Shanti, Indu, and Vijay. And immediately, I know something is up because my father never, ever physically exerts himself. I start to panic as we stumble past those happy golfing families on to a quiet dirt path. He motions for me and my sisters to sit at a picnic table, turns to my oldest sister and says, Shanti, are you having sex? Dad, I'm a third year resident. I'm too tired to have sex. Good, good girl. Indu, are you having sex? Dad, I'm 26 years old, still living at home, and thoroughly repulsed that you're asking me this question. No, I'm not. Good, good girl. Vijay, your mother has found something that leads her to believe that you are having sex.
I had gotten rid of everything. There was nothing at home that would give me away, so I decided to stay calm, poker-faced, play the reasonable adult.
Daddy! I don't know what you're talking about.
What did she find?
She won't tell me. She said, if she tells me, I will kill you. Look, Vijay, I am a liberal guy. Not like mommy. You can tell me. Yeah? I know you kids, you go to college, you smoke, you drink, you have sex. So tell me, Vijay, are you a virgin? I didn't want to lie to my dad, because I never directly lied to my parents before. Well, Dad, I think that's just too personal to discuss. Well, then, you've answered my question. And in that moment, I could see that he was no longer looking at me, but through me. And I was losing him, losing my family, losing my place. I'd stopped being good, being the baby, being Indian. I was becoming something different, foreign, American. And I had to make a choice. Daddy, of course I've never had sex. I'm still a virgin. I'm still good.
I knew it. Your mother, she's crazy.
I told her, my daughters, they're not loose like the Chopra girls, but they're from Bombay. What do you expect?
And as he chattered on, I felt the fragility of my life and relief as I saw those shattered pieces moving back into place. I felt so loved, safe, whole. I felt like a virgin.
My mother has a huge family. And every year, they have a family reunion. And she's always trying to get me to go. Come on, let's go. I haven't gone since I was a little kid. Finally, she wore me down. All right, let's go. We was getting our family reunion on, you know, bean bagging and horseshoes. It's a 3-day affair. And my mama said, look ahead. You got a cousin that lived up in Malaysia. You live in Malaysia. I want you to go talk to her right away. She's right over the hill. Get over there. All right. How you doing? What's going on, La? Bahasa Malaya, La. And she's like, I don't speak none of that nonsense. My mom tells me you lived in Malaysia. Did you have a good time over there? Better still, I got a question for you. Have you accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as your personal savior? Well, you know what? My religion is kind of complicated. And, you know, I'm just live and let live right now. We're just in the middle of this family reunion. I asked you a question. Have you accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as your personal savior? It was real nice meeting you. I'm gonna go stand over here now. And she said, what? Excuse me, what did you say? Hey, you speaking in tongues at me? I don't appreciate people speaking up in tongues at me. Please stop speaking in tongues at me. Because guess what? Guess what? You ain't the only one that can speak in tongues. I gave right back as good as I got. And she's getting it. And you got to understand, speaking in tongues around my family is like hitting the 911 button. People came, it's an emergency. People came quick, running, top speed. What is going on? And I am the obvious interloper. So they start speaking in tongues, helping out. And the force is strong with them. The force is strong. So they're pushing me back, right? And I finally, I know I got to give up the ghost, and I start running back over the hill. I'm running over there at top speed myself. I'm gone. And there my mother is, drinking some lemonade. So, son, did you meet your cousin?
I'd like to give some big love to the beat behind the beat, the guy that composed the music behind every single story that you just heard. His name is Mr. Alex Mandel. And the Snap Judgment players, Tim Frick on the bass and David Brandt on the sticks. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we love you, appreciate it. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. I'd like to thank everyone that has shown Snap Judgment Live, Snap Judgment Love. We have been overwhelmed. Thank you. And we'd like you to know that we're doing our biggest show ever in New York City, May 8th. We're going to call it Evolution. Stories you are not going to believe. And if you're in the area, or if you can get to the area, we'd love to see you there. Tickets available right now at snapjudgment.org. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. This is NPR. Storytelling.